Blog Talk Radio.
Ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am doing great. Doing great. You have had an eventful week or so, haven't you?
Yes. Well, you know, we were going to have a show last week, and then I was overtaken by events. Last Saturday, my oldest daughter, got married, and the preliminaries leading up to that just overwhelmed us. We had rehearsal dinners, and we had meeting parents events going on, and other preparatory things, and it was too much to do all that and a show in the same week, and I wouldn't have had the right focus on the show anyway. So, but now here I am, you know, still
and,
in that,
you know,
joyful flow.
And I grudgingly said, okay, well, we'll give you a little time to be with your family and do family things.
Yeah, well, you know, I had taken much the same attitude when you had to take your son to college.
Exactly.
And when he graduated from high school. Jesus, one thing after another with these people.
Yeah,
but,
I tell you.
But, you know, that's, you know, we do a weekly show as often as we can. I think that's
that's fair to
way,
say.
The way we
that's right.
We do a weekly show quite often. It's weekly, and when it's not weekly, then it's when it is. But yeah, it was great. It was a great event. Very very happy time in the family. Kind of glad that we've moved to the next stage. Not to say I'm glad it's over or anything like that, but it's nice to be back to normal life. It's great to be back here on the show too. And we got a fun one tonight.
Oh man, it's gonna be great. This is a great one. I think what we got here is a build up of awesome topics, so that, you know, there's not gonna be a moment of, you know, not a downer moment in this show. So
we don't have any time to waste. I'll tell you, this list of topics had me in such a state of mind. The announcer lady at the beginning said Blog Talk Radio. I really expected the old da 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 da. I thought the old fast forward radio music was going to come on. It feels like a show from the heyday, from the old fast forward radio days. Not that I got anything against our current theme music. Jean Sebastian Muse has graciously let us use this thing for 4 years now. We've been using this kind of Star Trek-y sounding thing, and I like it a lot. But I don't know. I almost feel like that old music would go better with these topics somehow.
Well, we'll try to back out sometime, but yeah.
we got to get it back sometime. For one thing, I don't think we've ever done a show with the word nuke in the title, have we?
You know what? I don't think we have.
I certainly not as a verb, you know.
Yeah. and it's not even a downer topic, you know. Nuke is in the title.
Not at all.
So, you know,
we're going to nuke Mars because, damn it, somebody has to do something. That's what I said on Facebook. And
that's right. Well, here's the real thing. You know, Elon Musk has been compared to Iron Man.
Yes.
And now Colbert is calling him a supervillain.
Right.
Where do we fall on this? That's the real question we need answers to. You know, are we dealing with, you know, we do we have Tony Stark or do we have Lex Luthor here? Yeah.
He's Tony Stark, I think, for sure. You know, he's Hank Reardon for the Ayn Rand fans out there. You know, he's the guy with the he's Prometheus stealing fire from heaven, right? Okay, to take it back to a more mythological place. No way is Elon Musk a bad guy. Even when he suggests nuking a place, it's for all good reasons, right? I mean, what do you think? What's your take? Is he showing his dark side?
Okay, so he's on the Colbert Show, right? And he's and the subject of Mars comes up as you would expect it to, because you know Elon Musk has said he wants to not only put people on Mars, but that's where he wants to go and spend his final years. And so the subject of Mars came up, and how do we make it a better place to live? Make it warmer, and he suggests, well, we nuke the poles. And I'm not sure quite how he would think that that would help, but I guess it would make the planet wetter if you nuke the ice caps at the poles.
In that interview he had given some specifics on what the mechanism is for nuking the poles of Mars, making it warmer and more Earth-like. Because that's an interesting idea, but where exactly does it come from? I would hypothesize that it's along the lines you said. You're gonna blast those ice caps. You're gonna put water vapor into the atmosphere. You're gonna put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and maybe you get a little bit of a greenhouse effect, and it starts to warm the planet up. You know, I guess.
In the article that you linked to, Phil, one of the critics of this idea said that, yeah, you could just as easily end up with a nuclear winter problem where you put enough dust into the atmosphere that it cools Mars even further, if that's possible. And, not necessarily a good idea. We, need to heat it instead. So, obviously when you offer an idea, as outlandish sounding as let's nuke Mars, a little more detail, needs to be offered, and the Colbert Show is not the forum for that. Colbert, his job is to be funny, and so he took the time to accuse Musk of being a supervillain, so, whatever.
Said he should run for president in the same interview, right?
Yeah, he said that too. Of course, Lex Luthor.
Colbert's all over the map. Good point. Okay, excellent. That's an excellent point. And Tony Stark totally should. So there you go.
Tony Stark told Bruce Banner in the last movie, embrace your mad scientist. Remember that? So
that's right.
No,
there
it's
you go.
The line between a superhero and supervillain is a thin one in the at least in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Well, there, that's another discussion, but I was just having this conversation with my son earlier. He had one of the storybooks, and Wolverine and Hulk are fighting. And he's like, Daddy, why are they fighting? And I said, Son, the good guys always fight in Marvel. Okay, it's one of the rules. All right, what can I tell you? They're always mad at each other. They're always getting fights with each other.
Yeah.
And he said, well, why? And I said, because it's more, and I you have to picture me doing the air quotes, okay, realistic, okay? That's why they do it. All right, so there you go. Anyway, that's a digression. We can debate the relative merits of DC versus Marvel one of these days. And I should point out, obviously, that the next big DC movie is Superman versus Batman, right? So I guess
exactly.
I guess that idea is catching on. But anyway. Okay, so this whole idea of making Mars more Earth-like, making it more hospitable to life, this comes from, this is an idea that's been around for a while. It's called terraforming, and it's not an idea exclusive to Mars. There's plans or ideas around how you might terraform the moon or how you might terraform Venus or, go out in the, we've got all these planets to choose from now out in interstellar space, find one that's most of the way there anyway, right? Make a few tweaks, and then you've got an Earth-like planet that people could live on, and plants from Earth could grow on, and animals from Earth would thrive on. It's a great idea, terraforming.
Yep.
The one hurdle you have to clear before you terraform any place, is there can't be any life on it already. This is the old Project Genesis in Star Trek II. Keeping the geek cred going here for a moment, you know. McCoy says, what would happen if you did this on a planet that already had its own life? And Spock says, well, it would replace such life in favor of its own matrix, which is why in the movie they were looking for a completely lifeless planet on which to put life, because we don't want to come in and colonize and invade and do away with biodiversity in the universe. So we would only think about making Mars more human habitable if we knew there wasn't anything else already living there. But assuming there's not, there are probably other ways, probably even you might say better ways of getting to an Earth-like Mars than nuking the poles. As you know, as much fun as that sounds like, I remember going back as far as, gosh, like the late 1970s. I can't remember if it was Isaac Asimov had written an article, or it might have been something by Carl Sagan, but before the Viking lander landed, and before we started getting a really good idea of what the chemical composition of Mars was, one of the theories for why Mars is so red was that it's rusty, that there's a lot of iron there, and the iron has soaked up, you know, it's been oxidized, and you're looking at just this big pile of rust when you look at Mars. I don't believe that anyone says anything remotely like that anymore. But at the time, that was an idea. That was the thought that, oh, okay. Well, what you could do then is you could put a big machine on Mars. In fact, you have robots just lay out a bunch of these big machines on Mars that would just go around picking up the dust on Mars, which is this oxygenized iron, and just, you know, de-rust it, deoxygenate it, and pump the oxygen out into the atmosphere. And over a period of a couple of centuries, or you know whatever the time frame was, eventually you get enough oxygen into the atmosphere of Mars, and it would start to warm up, and it would be a much more Earth-like place. I remember that idea had some, had some legs back in those days, and that was before we were sending, you know, mobile robot probes or any of that kind of stuff around. So it was a very imaginative, very speculative idea. But those kinds of ideas have been around for quite a while. And I think as we get closer to moving ourselves into space, we're going to see more serious attention devoted to, one, how do you make habitats in space that are, you know really accommodating for long-term habitation by people, whether they're in orbit or, you know, whether they're on asteroids or whether they're on other planets, you know, just as far as strictly artificial environments go. And then, two, how do you create kind of these quasi-natural environments that we can live in. And that's what gets us to this really interesting statement from DARPA. This is linked in our show notes on blogtalkradio.com and also over at worldtransform.com. This story that ran on Motherboard. We seem to be quoting Motherboard every now and then. They do some interesting stuff. DARPA, oh, yeah. We are engineering the organisms that will terraform Mars, and this is a really interesting way to go about it. Okay, DARPA is pumping big money into genetic research, and one of the researchers they talked to there says basically they're putting together the Google Maps of genomes. Okay, so they're starting to look at every microbe that exists, every insect, every plant, you know, all the megafauna and megaflora, everything that's alive on this planet now, they're starting to look at those genetic codes, how they match, how they're different from each other, how bits can be, you know, snipped from here and there, and little bits of, you know, think of it as a big, what's it called? I can't think of the name of it. That place where all the coders share their code, where all the programmers share their code. Something bit. I can't think of it anyway. But think of it as like that, right? It's like this library.
Like a BitTorrent?
Yeah, like that, you know? Like this library of computer code, and now you can just, you know, if you're a pretty good programmer, you can start going, and you go, well, there's a piece I can take, and I can tweak that a little bit, and here's a good, you know, routine that I can just plug right in here, and here are some objects. And pretty soon, you're writing a completely new program out of parts that already existed. Well, they're talking about doing that with genomes. And they're talking about all the different positive organisms that you can, you know, that you can create as a result of that. And some of those could be used to good effect on Earth. Some of them could be used to, like, you could release agents into the air that would fight diseases, for example. You know, imagine instead of having a flu shot, you know, what if they just released an anti-flu virus and into the atmosphere every year, right, about the same time as the flu, you know, one keyed exactly to it, so everybody would be catching the anti-flu rather than the flu. Ideas like that, ideas around how to reconstruct parts of the Earth that have been geologically damaged, or excuse me, that have been damaged biologically in some way or another, and then ultimately ideas for how this same kind of technology could be used to build kind of the building blocks of an atmosphere and completely different conditions on Mars. You know, right. It's like you work from the ground up, from microbes that are producing oxygen to those that are helping to create a more water-friendly environment, to those that are adding the right ingredients to the atmosphere to make it warm up, et cetera, et cetera. And over time, ultimately, these biological agents just transform Mars from what it is right now. I mean, we look at it and we say it's a very inhospitable, very cold, very dry, dusty place into something that might be a lot warmer, a lot wetter, and with an atmosphere that we could breathe. And you would do it, this would have to take a while, right? I mean, I think any terraforming project is probably going to take a while, isn't it?
Well, back in the 90s, there was a series of articles in, I believe it was Science Magazine, it was the cover story, and then, like, you know, I don't know, at least 10 or 12 page spread on the subject of terraforming Mars, and it went through the stages that you'd have to do according to this plan that they were laying out, and it was a 500-year plan. And at the end of the 500 years, it envisioned a planet where humans could walk around with breathing apparatus. It would be a little bit like walking in the high Himalayas, and you'd need some additional oxygen. And the reason you could never get it to where it would be like, you know, Earth at sea level is Earth is more massive and has the gravity to hold an atmosphere that would be thick enough to provide for our needs. And so, even at the end of 500 years, you know, normal humans could not breathe. But my thought is, you know, if we can change Mars that much, we could change ourselves. And so we not only would we terraform the planet, but we'd also engineer ourselves to be able to survive. With the lower gravity, with the thinner atmosphere, you know, you can do things to allow us to survive. At that point, you know, our children at that point might be more mechanical than biological anyway. So who knows? It's we're talking about a future that's 500 years from now. Who knows what we're dealing with at that point? But it was a 500-year plan in that particular article. So,
I just got to say, you know, give me 500 years, and I'll figure out a way to put some filler into the atmosphere to make it heavier, so you can have higher pressure. You know, 500 years, we could figure out how to make Mars way more, right, or make gravity greater. You know, I mean,
you can solve a lot of problems.
There's all kinds of options. But what you said is absolutely right. I mean, those are the two ways to solve the problem, right? You can change Mars so it's more hospitable to humans, or you can change humans so they fit in better on Mars. And if we ever discover that there is life on Mars, that would be the way we would have to do it, right? If we wanted to, quote-unquote, terraform Mars, we would have to kind of Mars-Aries form humans, right, so that they could live there without becoming a problem to the life that's already there. Well, that's I kind of like that better. You know, if it only took 100 years, that would be amazing. But when you start talking about a project that takes 500 years, you know, to spend half a millennium doing something, that seems like the kind of projects we should be working on, don't you think, you know?
Yeah. Another planet, within short hailing distance, you know, that would be a project worthwhile, no doubt.
Absolutely, yeah, I like that. Well, While we're on the subject of terraforming, we've got this other story about the largest air purifier ever built, and it sucks up smog and turns them into gemstones. This was over on Gizmodo, and the question is, what's 23 feet tall, eats smog, and makes jewelry for fun? And this is just an amazing piece of equipment. It's just this big 23-foot-high tower that scrubs 30,000 cubic meters of air per hour. So it's taking smog out of the air, and all the particulates that it's taking out of there, it's compressing them together, and it's making, you know, what they're calling, in quotes, gemstones. One of the ways they're kind of funding this project on Kickstarter is people are buying the jewelry, right? They're buying this this pollution-based, pollution-derived jewelry. Well, this is a great idea in its own right. Interesting that this was done in Europe, although the design, the whole idea was kicked off as something to deploy in Beijing. It was something to be deployed right in China, where they really need it. I'm sure there are parts of Europe where they need it pretty bad too. But you hear these stories about the smog problems that they have in China, and they could really benefit
from.
No
place on Earth is quite as bad as that. Unless maybe you're talking with, you know, there are a couple of cities in the United States that have a particular problem, Denver being one of them. It's the geography. You know, it doesn't allow the smog out easily. And Salt Lake City in Utah has a similar problem.
Right.
Yeah, if you could get a bunch of these towers producing gems. Now, here's the thing. We're talking not, you know, when I saw this article at first, I was thinking, well, what is it doing? Is it taking CO2 out of the atmosphere? You know, because we got this greenhouse gas issue, right? So let's take CO2 out and make diamonds with it. No, it's not. That's not what this thing is doing, though.
No. Although, it, you know, this is a step in that direction, if you ask me. I mean, to me, this is like the friendliest, what's the word I'm looking for? This is an innocuous way to get people on board with geoengineering, things like this, right? Because who's going to have a problem with filtering the pollution out of the air? I think everybody can get on board with that, because you say, okay, well, look, we put all this junk in the air, and it'd be better if the air was clean, so we're going to put up this thing that sucks the junk out of the air. I mean, everybody has got to be on board with that idea. Well, when you start talking about geoengineering, you're really talking about the same principle, and the device you just described, Stephen, would be exactly that, right? Tower that is not, you know, you could put it right next to this one, right? The clean air blows out of one end of this and blows into the other end of the other tower, and then it takes out some of the carbon dioxide, right? So we've put too much CO2 into the atmosphere. Let's take some of it out. And this is a way to offset carbon that doesn't. What's the term I'm looking for? This is the other end of the process way of addressing CO2 emissions, right? Right, you know, rather than catch them going out or prevent them from going out, you catch them once they're already out, right?
So it's the ultimate awesome in that sense, and also it's sequestering it permanently, okay?
Yes.
You know, in jewelry, whether we're talking about, you know, whatever kind of jewelry you're making out of smog, and then, you know, if you could make diamonds out of the CO2, that would be awesome. There is a PJ Manny on Facebook, a link to an article that's right on point with this, Phil. Giant fans will soon suck CO2 out of the atmosphere and turn it into fuel. Now, the difference, of course, now is, and the difference here is that this would be producing fuel that would then be burned, and the CO2 would be back in the atmosphere. So you're thinking, well, what good have we done there? Well, it wouldn't be as good as making diamonds out of the excess CO2, but what it would be is a carbon neutral fuel source.
Right.
Much like you know, the biofuel you would get from using algae. The algae uptakes the CO2 out of the atmosphere, produces fuel for you. You burn your fuel, so you have the use of this fuel. And then, of course, the CO2 is back in the atmosphere. But at least you're not pulling CO2 out of the ground in the form of coal or, you know, hydrocarbons and burning it and putting it into the atmosphere. This, you know, you're at least taking CO2 out of the atmosphere first and then putting it back. So you're not making things worse with solutions like this project that PJ Manny linked to. And let me see if I can kind of give you a it's from Big Think. So,
oh, okay.
And so if our listeners are interested in checking that out, it's Big Think, giant fans will soon suck CO2 out of the atmosphere and turn it into fuel. So that would be a neat project.
Well, there you go. And you know, I think there's a nice continuum from things like this air filter sucking out smog to a solution that takes carbon out of the atmosphere and is carbon neutral, to ultimately maybe one farther down the road as technology develops that does exactly what you said, that takes carbon out of the atmosphere and makes diamond powder, you know, that could be used for diamondoid nanotechnology, right? I mean, diamonds are a valuable thing. I mean, you know, they're useful.
Well, we could build our space elevator, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about with carbon nanotubes. So, you know, maybe that's what we need. We need a project like this to sequester enough, you know, of these things, so we build a carbon neutral space elevator. There's the project the world needs right there.
That's a good project right there. Not only carbon neutral. This is the
be sequestering
a climate change reversing space elevator. Basically, it's what you're.
Yeah, you're doing the opposite of what the rockets do, right? The rockets are polluting the atmosphere.
That's exactly right. The rockets are putting all this junk in the air. This is actually taking the stuff out, and in the process, it's making the alternative, cleaner way of getting into space. That's brilliant, Stephen. That's awesome. What was I going to say about that? What's great about those kinds of ideas is they move us in a direction towards ultimately when we're just kind of climate. People get really nervous when you talk about this, but even our efforts at preventing damage speak to an ultimate future of climate control, right? Eventually, we want to be in control of the climate, because the bottom line is, if we had never pumped any carbon in, right? If you could prove that that human beings had never done anything to impact the climate at all, we know that eventually, based on the history of the planet up to this point, eventually there will be like a horrible ice age, or there will be like these really hot swampy periods, or whatever, right? I mean, the climate will change, right? It's going to be at some point in the future vastly different from what it is right now, just because that's what happens on this planet. The climate keeps changing. So we can look at it and say, well, because we put all this carbon in the atmosphere and now it's going to get hotter, we want to prevent that, we'll do things. But if we didn't think we were doing it, right? In fact, if we knew for a fact we weren't doing it, but we also knew the temperature was going to go up 10 degrees in 100 years or 20 degrees in 50 years or, whatever it is, wouldn't we want
to,
prevent that from happening?
We still need to do something about it.
Yeah,
Need to do something about it. 10 degrees would destroy us. I mean, that would
right, be, exactly. Or if we go down 10 degrees, right? We would want to prevent that. So it's almost like we're moving in the direction of having some kind of vast, elaborate thermostat for the planet. And I think once we have that, once we've achieved that level of technology, that's probably when we can comfortably start talking about terraforming other planets, right? It's like, okay, that we'd be far enough along at that point that we could talk about doing things like that, and it wouldn't be completely.
I would agree with you, except for a small matter of politics, Bill. If Elon Musk manages to be the first to Mars and he decides, you know what, it's a little cold around here, I think I'll heat things up, and then he does it, there's not a lot of people there that would disagree and cause trouble if he just decided to do what he wanted to do.
Right.
You know, if you're there, you just do what you, I'm the king of Mars. I'm the only person there, but I'm the guy. And you can do what you want to do. But if we decided, hey, it's getting a little warm, it's getting warm for you, says the Canadians, but it's just getting perfect for us.
Yeah, we're having a lovely spring, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. You don't get to decide without our input. And so yeah. uh, you, you I think that it would, you know, it would be a constant battle of the of who gets to decide who touches the thermostat, right? I mean, it's bad enough in a single house.
It, you know what, it would, and I've got a potential solution to that, and we'll come to that later. Actually, I've got an idea.
Sure.
For how we could potentially address that, because you're absolutely right. You know, how would we ever get the whole world to agree on what the you know, you can't get one household to agree on what the thermostat should be set at. How are you going to get a planet to agree? Well, I've got an idea, but I don't think we're ready for that one yet, because first we've got to talk a little bit about Star Trek style teleportation is possible. Theoretical physicist believes we could be beaming to other planets within decades. You saw this in the Daily Mail.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
Okay, so here's the thing. Michio Kaku, brilliant guy, very entertaining guy. Is he just grabbing headlines here, or is he telling us something new? Have you read the piece, Stephen? What's your take?
He's doing both. He does grab headlines. That's kind of his thing. I think he's been on Big Bang Theory more than once. So he's not afraid to put himself out there. His self promotion's a lot of scientists look down on that. He does not. He self promotes like crazy. Anyway, and he comes up with a lot of interesting ideas. One he mentioned was a while back was the idea of we're understanding the human brain better. In a few years we ought to be able to do stuff like you saw in Total Recall, where we give ourselves a vacation, the memory of a vacation.
Yep.
And Total Recall style. And hopefully it wouldn't result in all the problems you see in that movie. But anyway. I think he's also spoken about the Star Trek technology of warp drive in the past too. And he talks about things that are fun to talk about, and but brings real science to bear in it. And in the teleportation, he's talking about how we're already doing teleportation, at the very small levels, not full atoms even yet, right? What are we teleporting at this point?
Quantum states and things like that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And they can do some interesting things with entangled particles and things like that. And
Well, I take that back. Previous studies have shown atoms teleporting across a room and light being teleported across the Danube River. Okay, so we've teleported light.
And it says here
atoms. Okay, so some actual entire atoms have been. So we're not giving teleportation technology credit here. Apparently, we've gotten to the energy stage and the matter stage. It's not just quantum states any longer. We're actually moving bits of energy, and we're moving, if I assume that's how you count photons, and we're moving matter. If I'm to understand what this says about they've teleported atoms, right? Okay, so a few atoms at a time. Let's say that's where we are right now, or we'll be there soon, if assuming that the person who wrote this for the Mail got ahead of themselves.
Yeah, I have no doubt that they'll scale this up. And the way we can expect the technology to do is it gets exponentially better, right? It's maybe an atom or two this year, and imagine if they do it exponentially on a yearly basis. Two atoms next year, four atoms a year after that. How long, Phil, until you and I can, teleport into low Earth orbit? Quite some time, but, that's the funny thing about exponential advance. It sneaks up on you how quickly it goes from being an interesting thing in a lab to being Earth-changing.
This is the thing that that Ray Kurzweil said to us first time he was on the show, and I think he reemphasized it the second time he was on. The difference between taking linear steps and exponential steps. If you take, if you take 30 exponential steps, you've moved like 30 feet, right? And if you take 30 exponential steps,
just the opposite.
I'm sorry.
Just 30 linear steps will get you to your mailbox.
If you take 30 linear steps, you've moved like 30 feet. If you take 30 exponential steps, you've moved like a billion times a step.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. You've gone around the Earth like, 40 times or something crazy.
Yeah.
Exponentials, our human brains are not built to, that's not in our normal daily experience, exponential thinking is just not part of our normal reality, but it's becoming our normal reality, isn't it? We've seen exponential development in computers and in all sorts of technology, and I think that we may see something like that in this. Now, obviously, there's a couple of things that need, a lot needs to happen before it becomes something that would be used to transport people. You need assurances, Phil, that we make the trip. And this is something we've talked about every time we bring up transportation. It's like, what a great technology. You first, Phil. I think I would be like the Dr. McCoy of the Star Trek universe. I'll take the shuttlecraft. Thank you.
Here's the thing. Because what they're talking about is teleportation based on quantum entanglement, I can at least I can entertain the idea of doing it, and that is based on the idea that that perhaps my totality of subjective experience, my complete being of being who I am, is encoded in my quantum states. I don't know that to be the case. And it might actually be encoded at a much less granular level, or at a much more granular level. Right? That's the thing. We don't really know. We don't really know what we are. That's the beauty about being human. We have some big, broad ideas about what we are, but we're not 100% sure what we are. And so, if you say that you're taking me and breaking me down into my basic parts on one end of the beam, and then putting me back together on the other end of the beam. Yeah, the question is, did everything come along for the ride that needed to come along for the ride? Specifically, me, right? Is the thing the thing that I think of as myself.
Regardless of whether it would happen, it would always be, I like the old feel better.
That's right. Or even worse, I like you a lot better since you've done this a few times.
Yeah,
you should do it a few
right.
more
Look,
times.
The thing that you left behind, you needed to leave behind, buddy. It was
whatever
it was
you're leaving
fun.
Out, yeah. Go beam a few more times. It's working for you.
Come back we'll do the show then. Yeah.
But to me, that's predicated on the idea that there's only one set of me, right? Because anytime you talk in terms of it making a copy and it sends the copy, well, then it's like, okay, well, then good for you, copy, but I don't, and the copy will show up and think he's me. So that's real close, but, me, the guy who got left behind and killed, I find that, to say the least, highly unsatisfying, okay? That does not work for me at all. he talks, what he said at this, it was actually at a Big Think, in a Big Think interview, he said, in the coming years, we expect to be able to teleport molecules, maybe water and carbon dioxide. After that, who knows, maybe even DNA. And then he speculates further that we can start at some point teleporting animals. And then once we've proved we can do it, we're ready for people. Now, who are the people who are going to go? They're going to be people, Stephen, who do not have the qualms you and I have, right?
Right,
And I know there are many in the, singularitarian / transhumanist community who will tell you, ha, 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 I'm a patternist. I am but a pattern. And as long as the pattern's there, I'm there. And they'd be the first to sign up, right? Assuming that it's that it's been established as safe, and they look at guys like us with our reservation as I think that they see that attitude as kind of like the Aborigines who are afraid the camera's going to steal your soul, right? That's their view of us.
And you would definitely and you definitely want to choose from people of that philosophical bent to be the first people to try, right?
Yeah.
So
you don't want to make anybody do it, right?
That's right. At gunpoint, you're getting in that machine, and we're gonna and by the way, you might want to get the fly out of there with you. That's probably not going to be good. But anyway.
Definitely make sure, yes.
Yeah, it's fly-free.
You grade maxed thoroughly before you...
before you get in there.
Yeah.
But I would think that it would be hugely energy intensive, and so that would be another thing that would need to perfect is the energy efficiency, because I would imagine the amount of energy to beam a person to orbit would be astronomical. You know, the amount of energy required with what we currently know, but what we currently know changes all the time. So.
Well, and this has always been one of the big arguments against Star Trek technology. You know, we've seen some Star Trek technology show up in our own lives with the communication devices and the computers, and then others that when serious scientists look at them, say, well, I don't know, this faster than light, the amount of energy it would take to even get near the speed of light, and then there's no way to transcend the speed of light. So, you know, there's that whole argument. And usually then they'll say, but as if that weren't bad enough, then you've got this transporter beam, which is completely preposterous, right? It's like you would need, I've heard it argued, you would need, you know, the power of the sun, basically, to beam Kirk from Earth to low Earth orbit. But I'm not sure that that's necessarily looking at using the technique they're talking about here. I'm not sure that... that when those criticisms were raised, we were talking in terms of quantum entanglement as the means of providing teleportation. And to your point, Stephen, we're getting better at this stuff all the time. Plus, who says we can't produce a sun's worth of energy? You know, if we need to get somebody someplace.
Yeah.
But
at some point. Yeah.
What I like to think about is, what if it did work and it was cool and somehow you could know it was safe? What a thought! You know, he's talking about teleporting people to other planets. Even if we were talking about the space, the space elevator as being the clean way to get to orbit. I mean, imagine if you could just beam up, right? If you could just beam to the moon, right? And
beam to
ultimately,
Mars.
Yeah, quantum entanglement is spooky, whatever it is, spooky action at a distance. The distance can be any distance. This ultimately, as odd as it might seem, could be the way to explore the universe. This could be the way to perform interstellar travel, to perform intergalactic travel. Obviously, we're talking about a highly advanced technology, way, way beyond what anyone is doing currently. But this is the way to do it, just in terms of, not having to build these massive spaceships and figure out, how to trick a black hole into letting you go faster than light, all those kind of things, right? This is something that we know actually does happen faster than light, right? That's been established. Quantum entanglement really does seem to transcend the light barrier. So if we're ever gonna move faster than light, this is a kind of a promising way of making it happen. And the idea of a future wherein humans are just kind of beaming around the universe is, I don't know, it's pretty freaky, but I kind of like it.
Yeah, and that is a like you say, far future. But it's funny how when we're talking about exponential advances in technology, the far future may be closer than we realize. And so I'm glad that at least this one scientist that is talking about some of these far off things and saying, you know what? There are some theoretical reasons that there is a basis for believing this is within the realm of possibility, and so that's
absolutely
awesome.
Yeah. Even if he's just grabbing headlines, good work, Dr. Kaku. Keep grabbing headlines by getting people to think about these kinds of things, because I think these are worth
they're thinking about how he's got to be wrong. Look about how he's wrong, and they take a second look at these ideas, and so it's not a bad thing. Anyway,
we got a couple more, and one of these, I try to do these in a kind of an order because one of the problems with working out stuff like quantum entanglement is, you reach this limit for how much really our brains can understand or process or comprehend, and so now we've got this TV show coming out, Limitless, based on the movie of the same name, about a guy who discovers a drug that vastly improves his brain power. And I haven't actually read the piece that we linked to on the site. I just saw that the show was coming out, and I intend to catch up. And I was on last night. I guess it premiered last night. I do want to see this because I thought we did a show about the movie, I think, when it first came out. And It's an intriguing idea. What do you think, Stephen? Are we closing in on taking smart pills, and are you going to sign up?
I may not be the first person in the line of field, but I think absolutely there is a lot that could be done biochemically to at least on a temporary basis, like this show would indicate, to give ourselves a temporary boost when you need it. And I think that there's every reason to believe that that's possible. And the movie Limitless had the actor Bradley Cooper. He is not apparently going to be on in this new television show like every episode, I don't think. But they bridge it. This new television show is meant to be a sequel, I believe. And and so Bradley Cooper actually does show up at least for the pilot, and so they're going to bridge the gap between the movie and this television series. And
can I just keep geeking out? Okay, I've already started geeking out tonight, so one more, can I? Kind of like Highlander the series, basically. It's like Highlander the series.
Yeah, exactly. A little bit like that.
Yeah. Sorry to slow you down, Stephen. Go ahead.
Well, the Highlander TV show was actually an improvement on the sequels that we saw in the movie theater. But
but it had the star in it to kind of kick the thing off.
Off. Well, I think that's what we're going to get. But it's also, this particular review that you linked to says, hey, this is great. Based on what I've seen with the pilot, I have every reason to believe that they're doing two things here. They're building up a story arc for the entire series that mm-hmm. they will cover in the entire series, and they're going to effectively do Monster of the Week. Okay, X-Files tried to do both, right? You have plot building shows, and you also have Monster of the Week. This reviewer says, I think that they're going to get it done every episode. In the same episode, they're going to do, here we're solving this crime and doing this thanks to the guy that's taking the Limitless drug, becoming Sherlock Holmes for, a period of time, but also at the same time you can be advancing the plot so this particular reviewer says great show, this one's going to be a big one in this fall, and so I'm going to be watching.
We're going to have to check this out. Okay, we're definitely going to have to check this out.
I answered your question, but I want to throw it back at you. What do you think about the possibility of this kind of technology? Here's a pill, Phil, it'll raise your IQ by about 20 points. You don't want to take it all the time. There's some side effects, but when you need it, here you go. What do you think?
Here's what I know. I know that I drink coffee for exactly that reason. And something I've learned about myself since I have become a full-time freelancer, I'm on very tight deadlines sometimes for producing content for my clients, I have learned the hard way, but it's an extremely valuable lesson to learn. I've learned that I write much better on an empty stomach. If I don't eat breakfast in the morning and I just sit down and start writing, I can get so much more productive, right? I can get so much more, and that's not actually taking anything. That's just not doing something, right? But clearly there's something inside my body.
Well, not even that biochemical effect.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And it may be just as simple as my body has to choose between powering the brain so I can write or digesting the food. And if I don't put it into a position where it has to choose between those two, I'm optimized for writing until lunchtime or so. And so I don't need breakfast anymore. It's like I get so much more work done. I don't need breakfast. Forget it. I like breakfast. I eat breakfast on the weekends, but when nobody needs me to think, right? But I haven't found any that I find truly effective, but I would take a supplement at this point if I thought, there was really a perceptible effect and the side effects weren't too bad. And I would be more than happy to try something like this if there was, a reasonable assurance that it wasn't going to kill me, right? That it wasn't going to make me really sick or do something horrible to me. Because I think it's worth it. being able to perform mentally versus not being able to. I mean, because that's one of the most frustrating things in the world when you're trying to get work done. Well, I'm sure you know how it is. You know, you're trying to produce work and you just can't quite get to the pace you need to be at. If there's something that can get you there, yeah, I would. I would totally take it.
It's why so many college students take what's the drug? Starts with an M.
Modafinil.
Modafinil. Yeah.
Yep.
They're saying it's being abused. I suppose it is. If it's not, if it's a prescription drug and you haven't been prescribed it, then legally, boys and girls don't take that. But the effect is that it makes, there are drugs that make you smarter. There are drugs that are prescribed to people that have various problems. But a normal person takes it and makes them more attentive to detail. It's not just for people with those problems. So. It doesn't just affect them. A person with perfectly, normal abilities, it takes it, and all of a sudden they seem smarter as well. And so it's an ethical conundrum, isn't it? I hope that they deal with that in the show. What if within the show they show that, it raises your IQ by 20 points. It's this, it's that. But you know what? It'll reduce your life expectancy by 15 years because you're burning your brain out when you take this stuff.
Well,
you know,
not
what
to
if
spoil
they, what
the
if they
movie,
introduce
but,
that idea. Yeah.
But I'm the sorry, movie deals with that. Okay, that's what the movie's
okay.
about, right? I mean, that is the trade-off in the movie. Not to spoil the movie. It's been out for a few years, and, I don't think I'm giving too much away. One of the things that happens...
Exactly what I would deal with if I were writing that movie.
One of the things that happens early on in the movie, it's not just 20 points of IQ. I mean, this guy's got this book writing project that he hasn't done anything on, and he takes the drug and he writes the book like in a weekend, right? I mean, it's just like he has been so advanced for it. It's kind of like Flowers for Algernon, I mean, he is suddenly this...
smartest man on earth.
Yeah, exactly. He's way ahead of everybody else, and he's seeing things, he's making connections, and for that kind of capability, you think, well, I don't know, because I want to live a long time. But if you could give me that, but you take a year off my life, but I could have that for a year. Think of how far you could get in your life in a year or two with that. That's a conundrum, okay, right there. That's a powerful trade-off to have to make. Now, if it's cutting your life, that's one thing. If it's cutting into your brain function later, if it's following the arc of Flowers for Algernon, not to spoil that story, but you people really should be familiar with it by now, but it's following that arc, and you're getting all this boost, and then later it's just going to, your brain's going to fall apart, who would do it, right? I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't want that. But if it's a sheer trade-off of extremely functional life now that shortens your overall life, I don't know, that's a tough choice to make. And that's speaking as somebody who hopes to live a long time too. So yeah, well, it'll be interesting to track that and see what kinds of things they do with it. But I must say that I'm ready to be signed up. However, we don't necessarily have to take drugs to be smarter because our machines are getting so smart. And we've got this last story here. The deep learning machine teaches itself chess in 72 hours, plays at international master level. I think, Stephen, I've mentioned to you that I've been working with a client that is doing a lot of work in artificial intelligence and deep learning. And we are in like a new golden age of machine learning artificial, narrow
neural
AI,
net,
they call
yeah.
it. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
neural nets.
Yeah.
That whole thing. We did a show about that. I don't know, about 6 months ago, right?
Right, right.
And
back when I was, when I started college in '87, Phil, it was this thing that it was just around the corner, and it was going to change the world. And when that didn't happen, it was like it sucked the oxygen out of that area of research.
Right.
And I think The truth of the matter is, it required more computation than we had available at the time. I think that was the big problem. And now that the computation keeps growing exponentially, and it's getting to the point where, you know, it mentions in this article, Phil, that I thought this was fascinating. You know, Deep Blue was this big, huge mainframe-sized computer that beat Kasparov. And how long ago was that? That was it's been more than a decade, but 20 years.
Yeah.
20 years. It beat Kasparov. You know, since then, chess-playing computers have become significantly stronger, leaving the best humans little chance even against a modern chess engine running on a smartphone.
Right.
I think that says something about you know, our chess algorithms, but it says more about the exponential development of our computers. That you know, we can run grandmasters now, with grandmaster level chess programs on a smartphone. And so, anyway, that's kind of beside the point here. This particular chess machine is doing it more like people, isn't it? It's not doing this brute force, just checking every possibility and going with the best one like machines have traditionally done. This is thinking like a person and not going down every branch of the tree to see what the best solution is, but pruning those branches the way a human does.
Right. It comes down to, you know, what you said earlier is right. You know, we have much more rapid and more powerful computation than we had in the past. But the other two things we have are much bigger data sets, and we have mm-hmm. much better algorithms. I think it's actually the algorithms that are really driving this revolution. Because what this program Giraffe is doing is it's looking at its position, right? And it's looking at that position relative to what the other positions may be, not trying to anticipate what all the future moves might be, but just what you do when you're in this particular position. And it's built up a series of understandings around, well, if I'm in this position, I do this. If I'm in this position, I do this. And by this position, I don't just mean you're sitting on this square. It means when you're sitting in this square and that pawn is there and that rook is there and that bishop is there, right? So it has put together this set of understandings of relationships between possible positions on the board it's really hard to imagine how much more sophisticated that is than just looking at this move versus, you know, trying to predict that one versus that one versus that one versus that one. It's much more sophisticated, and yet it takes less memory, right? I mean, it's actually a much smaller and more compact process to run that algorithm. But the astounding thing is to me the 72 hours, right?
Yeah.
The smartphone is pretty astounding too. Those are both equally amazing when you think about it. We went from something that could, that took years for us, the best programmers in the world, to now the program can teach itself to be a grandmaster of chess. And so, to close out my idea from earlier, we're not going to run over. We almost ran over last week. But to close out my idea from earlier, we got to start applying deep learning to the big problems of humanity, right? If it can learn to be a master level of chess right now, in this relatively backward age that we're in right now, imagine what these computers will be able to figure out in a few years, right? And in 72 hours. So I think we'll give the thermostat problem over to a really advanced AI, and that will probably be the beginning of the of the benign computer takeover of the world.
Well,
so that's my.
I think we start with an oncologist. You know, what's the best way to treat my cancer, computer? And go
exactly.
Go at it and. At any rate, the music tonight, Phil, is Smalls by Steady Hustle.
Steady Hustle with Smalls. Well, thanks, Stephen, for putting that together. Thank you all for being with us. And remember, you still got 2 days to go to the weekend because we're on Wednesday now. So enjoy your enjoy the rest of the week, and we'll be back again with an all-new show next week. Until next time, live to see it.
So take me down to your level. Oh, you know it's unstable up here from the way you move. So give me something to hold on to. No, I've never been a one to give in, but there's just something about you. So come on up, cause we can make headroom. In this room for one bedroom, you know that we can make room for two. So if you're good, then I'm better. With us just never leaving this room. But you pass out play from your earlier days has left you all alone. Put me in a put me in a